News Radio 1000 FM 97.7, taking a deeper dive. The conversations that left us wanting to know more. Complete coverage on the stories that matter to you. This is A Deeper Dive. Here's Kim Shepherd.
A Seattle veterinary clinic is getting ready to do something that has never been done before. Turn their group of privately owned animal hospitals into an employee-owned co-op. It's an effort that's been years in the making, but that the employees hope will be the change their industry needs.
I would ask you this, in your scholastic career from grade school to graduate school, did you ever learn about co-ops?
Of course not.
Of course not, right. Working in a
coal mine. Adam Schwartz is the founder of The Cooperative Way, a consulting firm with a mission to help co-ops succeed.
My license plate says Go Co-op. I am a big believer that the cooperative business model is the best business model on earth, because it takes into account both the economic and social needs of the members and the communities that they serve.
And for the past couple of years, Adam's been working with the owner and staff at Urban Animal, who are about to become the very first veterinary co-op in the country, and possibly in the world.
We are in the position to be able to be leaders, both within the facility and then within the industry.
Molly Rose Dunn is a client liaison at Urban Animal, a veterinary group with three offices in Seattle. She says they were just starting to consider the co-op idea when she interviewed 2 years ago, and it's part of the reason she accepted the job after going through two corporate takeovers at her previous hospital.
We were the hospital that unionized up in North Seattle. They will say that the hospital closed because they couldn't keep enough staffing, but they could not keep enough staffing because after we unionized, they froze wage increases for 3+ years, including through COVID.
Molly Rose says she's had to do some research, but the more she learns, the more excited she is about the idea and what it could mean for her future.
And I don't even know, to be honest. I am jumping in a bit blindly, other than just the idea that I've been holding on to from the beginning is that we're all in it together.
Veterinarian Michael Light says his initial reaction to the idea was not exactly enthusiastic.
I didn't have a lot initially because I wasn't really familiar with them. But after learning a little bit, it's exciting.
Dr. Light is part of the first group of employees that are going through a training process with the Cooperative Way as they prepare to take over their first stake in Urban Animal.
I think we're doing 6-hour-long meetings over the next few months.
Adam says the biggest hurdle for the employees will be learning how to work in a totally different way than they ever have before.
Most of us, when we were growing up, our families were not very democratic. And then we go to school and there's not really a whole lot of democracy in school. And then you go off to work and our workplaces aren't very democratic. So for a lot of people, getting used to what workplace democracy looks like, electing a board, selecting a management structure.
The employee group at Urban Animal will start with a 5% stake in the company, with the owner and founder offering to underwrite future loans when the co-op is ready to buy more. So who is this benevolent business benefactor? Dr. Sherry Trusheim is the founder and owner of Urban Animal with three locations in Seattle, a privately owned veterinary hospital soon to be transitioning to an employee-owned co-op.
I was, had been a veterinarian for 15 years. I was working in referral medicine, the 24-hour, lots of specialists. I was the emergency overnight. And it just wasn't feeling good. And back then, it was nothing like it is now, but it's just the cost of care, wow, people are making, really talented support staff are making $12 an hour, and this case was $20,000. It doesn't make sense to me. And it wasn't feeling good. And I was thought about going to bartending school. I was going to open a bar. I took the real estate course. I went to carpentry school full time, while I was a veterinarian, because I have an entrepreneurial spirit. But I just didn't want to do that. It was hard. And there's high burnout rate and high suicide rate. And it's just I was disenchanted. But then we opened this and I was I just want to do it my way. I grew up in the Midwest. I want candid conversations. I want to meet owners where they're at, right? I don't want to push an agenda, upsell anything. And I really think if I just do that and then I see the next one and see the next one and see the next one and do it in a walk-in fashion, it doesn't, they talk about average transaction that you have to have in each exam. I'm I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about business. I just want to be a veterinarian.
Right.
And I think if we do it, mindfully and I, anyway, so this wallpaper that we put in, a good friend of mine is a designer, and architect and designer is what I would have done now in hindsight if I wasn't a veterinarian. But it's just, it's sort of like all from, you know, early to mid-century, and it's like we've always had that connection with dogs and cats, right? And these dogs and cats probably weren't getting MRIs, and people weren't taking out second mortgages to pay for their care, right? But they loved them, and it's sort of like a celebration of the human-animal bond, you know? It's like you don't have to do an MRI on your neurologic old dog who probably has a brain, right? Like you can. And I think that like is where we started just really doing like an option-based style of care. Yeah. You know, it's like, here's what you could do. Here's gold standard. Here's everything in between.
Yeah.
And now there's zero judgment from our side. And we know, you know, I know people who like couldn't fathom their cat in a hospital. Like that breaks their heart so much that they're just like, no way. I would never hospital. You know, they wouldn't even hospital. And then there's other people who will just do chemo and keep fighting and, you know, do all the things. And I think what we try to do here is sort of embrace all of that,
right? Whether it's right or wrong.
Exactly. Like, it's not a judgment seat. And we know you love your pet. And, you know, and I think that makes it easier then for people. So
tell me about your three locations, right? Yeah. And how are each of them different or individual?
Well, up until just the end of August, they were all walk-in practices, meaning we just, you know, help people as they come. It's been super challenging over the last few years. And even now at 8:15, sometimes at the walk-in practice, we open at 8. At 8:15, we're almost full for the day. Like there's a line at the door, and that's, you know, people, there's a really strong push for folks to try to find, you know, affordable care. And there's not much out there anymore. And I think we have a reputation of just being candid and not upselling. So those two walk-in practices at Capitol Hill now and White Center are just walk-in. So people show up and we help them as we can, and we try to hold the price point down. And you do that honestly on a volume type basis. You just see as many folks as you can, right? And so people have to self-advocate a little bit in that model, right? It's like we're just seeing the next sick one in front of us. Oh, and we do exam, vaccines, like, you know, general wellness, but you sometimes have to wait in line. You know, the goal is eventually we grow to a size that we can meet that demand.
Sure.
Right now we can't. And then this one is more sort of client-centric, as far as we really want to have as much time as you need to talk about your concerns, and we'll call you the next day. You don't need to call us to see, you know, just a different, more, I want to say, hand-holding, you know, just like we can help you through this. Everything's, you know, and but we can't do that and keep the price point down. I mean, that's just... So this one is about 30% higher price point, and we try to be super upfront and communicate that with everyone on our website. We're like, which model is right for you? And we kind of walk it through, right? It's like time or money, and it ends up kind of shaking out.
So let's talk about what got you interested in even thinking about the co-op possibility.
Well, you know, when I opened Urban, it was just really VCA. You know, VCA was sort of the big corporate player, and they hadn't even been purchased yet by Mars, the candy bar company, who's now the biggest corporate player. Like, everyone thinks Mars is candies. I'm like, it's over 51%, I think, now an animal health company. They went from candy bars to animal health. And I mean, that has then, in the last decade, just skyrocketed. The corporatization of our industry is pretty out of this world, and it's even sometimes hard to track, because you always can't tell when private equity owns something who really owns it, right? But private equity is pulling the strings. Private equity is running that enterprise.
And the bottom line is running everything.
Exactly. So I knew with my entrepreneurial spirit that I wanted to grow something big. I wasn't just going to have one practice. I wanted to like sort of put this vision and idea out in the world, and I'm like, you know, it's going to be a big deal, and I know I never want to sell it to corporate.
Yeah.
And so early on, I knew I, quote unquote, wanted to be employee owned, but I really didn't know what that looked like. And I'm like, well, when I'm dead, the people own it. Like, that's just sort of, and now, you know, as I start to want to, you know, get a hobby farm, right? And start doing some other things.
So I feel you.
Oh, well, I need a consult afterwards. I'm like, I can't wait to get goats.
But they're the best.
I'm so excited to wake up every morning and have a goat. And, oh, I've wanted a horse since I was a kid. And I'm like, yeah, I just turned 50, but damn it, I'm getting one. But I don't have to get one by selling out. I think if what we can do, we do, right? Like, do what you are capable of doing in your space. And the reality is, I'm capable of doing something in my industry that makes it better, that leaves it better. And so that's what I'm doing. And like, to me, it just is kind of, I wouldn't feel good if I did something different, right? Yeah. And everybody does what, you know, their guiding light tells them to do, right? Yeah. There's no judgment around it. But I, you know, and I just did a talk at a veterinary conference in Tacoma for like Washington State. Uh-huh. And, you know, I started to just talk about like, it's hard to, you know, what's an exit strategy? And right now, corporate is, if you own a practice as a veterinarian that employs more than, say, two veterinarians, corporate wants to buy you and they will pay way more than a bank will loan an individual to buy you. That's the reality. So you do have to sort of turn your back and walk away from a lot of money to not sell to corporate, but to have an exit strategy, which everybody should have, right? You work your butt off. Like, you work 7 days a week. It's like, we were open 6 days a week, and on the seventh, I was at Costco getting paper towels, right? Like, it's like you put your whole life into it. It probably takes years off your life, and then you're like, I want to do something different. But our society, I'm fine. It's taken me 3 years to sort of like put it together, to find people that, like, we're just so wired to be like, well, you want to make as much money as you can, right? Like, well, no. You know, it's like, yes, of course, but not without, like,
at the expense of others.
Yes. Yeah.
So what does it actually look like? Like, because I just imagine, okay, you say, okay, I want to do a co-op, but then you think about, you have all these people who are going to be owning alongside you, and how do you screen them,
yeah.
And how do you bring them in, and how does it actually work?
You know, it's still grassroots, and I feel like it's been grassroots for, you know, 50 years, but there is a grassroots movement in this country, you know, regarding employee ownership and worker cooperatives and just cooperatives in general as a way to do business. You have to find those people, because the reality is, you're right, I gift a portion of the company to the worker cooperative. So in the state of Washington, there's an LCA, it's a limited cooperative association. It's only been a legal entity since 2019. So I can gift a portion to that entity, who the members of the entity or owners of that entity are the members of the worker cooperative. So now they own a chunk of the company, and then it's like getting into the housing market in Seattle, right? It's like, you just got to get in. And maybe you get a tiny one-bedroom condo, but what you really wanted was a house with a yard and goats and, you know, but you just got to get in where you can. And so they get in, and then we go with a growth mindset, and we're like, let's open more. Let's make more worker cooperative jobs, right? Let's give people, like, don't put a ceiling on stuff. That you can grow with the company, like, give opportunities, right? Nothing's perfect, but I think that model just makes so much more sense.
How does it work as far as, I'm just thinking about compensation, generally speaking, because I think about, you know, union models. Under a union contract, you might have like stock options or something like that. Mm-hmm. How does the co-op model sort of compare, or how could you explain it to folks?
So a co-op model is about, in a worker cooperative, you know, one membership, one vote. So for me, the reason, you know, I didn't go with an ESOP, let's say, which is great. I think sharing the company's profits with employees is phenomenal, but it doesn't say anything about governance, right? And that's the difference with a worker cooperative. And in an industry where corporate America is gobbling it up and telling veterinary professionals what their job should look like, right? They could not fathom why they do or why we do what we do. They're making money. That's all they're doing. And that's what's different about it is, yes, so it does also share profits. So one membership, one vote. And then we have a board, right? And the board, we weighted the board. So the board had a certain amount of guaranteed veterinarians on the board. So there's elected seats. And then the reality is, in this business exchange that we have, this is where a lot of folks would get uneasy, I think, is the way, and I had to find a lawyer who's a boutique law firm in Colorado, Jason Weiner Group. All they do is sort of structure employee ownership.
Okay.
And they're like, they dedicate their whole lives to it. It's really cool. And you know, along the way I've met a lot of, well, yeah, you can't do that. Like what worker cooperatives, how they usually form is an owner is ready to retire and they, you know, on favorable terms, sell the company to their employees and then they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. And that's usually like in a year's time or a few years time. Whereas I'm like, well, I don't need to be gone. I'm happy to like stick around and help sort of turn this into something. And so we're starting with just a 5%,
okay,
like 5% gift seed. And I kind of think of it as a seed. And so then we get going and we go with a growth mindset. And then over time, when it makes sense, because my whole goal is that the worker cooperative is successful, right? So I'm not gonna have some loan terms or sale terms that don't make sense for the co-op.
Okay.
So they need to be able to buy the company, right, at favorable terms. So I kind of think of it as like a family deal almost, right? It's like, oh, we had a bad month. No one saw that coming. Seattle lost power for 30 days, right? Like, or something crazy. You know, the business is doing great, and I think it will only do better when you put these guys in the driver's seat, right? It's just like, well, duh, of course, it's going to continue to be great. It already is great. It's got a great culture. We have great people. And now put them in the driver's seat, and there's no way it doesn't work. Like, it's just like, duh. And so then, you know, over the next 10 to 15 years, I'll sell tranches at a time, and we have... The thing about veterinary medicine is banks love us, right? Because they love to lend, because we always pay our debts. I could, you know, I wanted to open a bar, I wanted to remodel houses, and then I was like, no one's lending me money to do those things, but I could get a 100%, no, nothing down. They were like, we're a little concerned about your lack of equity. I'm like, you should be. All I have is student loans, right? Like, but they're just like, you're a sure thing because you're a veterinarian. So they will give you money to open a practice and start it. And it's hard to fail.
Yeah.
It really is, because there's tons of people that need help with their pets. All you gotta do is open your door. So we have a lender who is on board with this growth model, and they will lend to the co-op to buy the first tranche. And I personally guarantee the loan, right? Because I still own, you know, the majority of the company. But over time, and there are lenders out there who are more mission-based lenders, and I think we start connecting with them. And this is the kind of stuff that I think can change our economy. And so over time, like when I'm dead, it will be 100% owned by the people that work in it. It cannot be sold, right? And that's the thing about an ESOP. Again, it's great to share your profits, but the employees don't typically have a voice what happens with that company. You know, there's a very few people that make those decisions, and this is more, you know, put something good in perpetuity.
And the idea of kickstarting that generational wealth.
Yes.
I have kids who are between 13 and 18 right now. I've got four kids, and my oldest are in college, and they've already told me, Mom, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to buy a house.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, it breaks my heart to hear them say that.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me
to argue. And they're in college.
And they're in college.
They're in college.
So the idea of you're setting this up for not just your employees.
No.
But for
everybody.
I mean, can you talk about the enormity of what this really will mean for generations?
I just think, too, it just goes back to if we all, I mean, I think everybody knows things feel a little broken, right? Unless you're the 1%. And even then, I'd argue you probably should think things are broken, right? It's like if we all just do what we can do, then it would be different. But I'm still not battling, but I'm still working with CPAs who are so focused on my tax liability that I can't honestly get them to like, no, you're not hearing. It's not synthetic equity, it's real equity, right? Like they're just everything. Well, then this model, Sherry makes, you know. Yes, I want a hobby farm. I'd love a place in Palm Springs. There are some things I want, you know, but I think that's okay. I have some shame around it, right? Midwest roots. You know, I grew up lower middle class, and yeah, I just think it's broken. I think the system is broken. I think it's scary. I'm not giving it away. I am not a saint. I'm a business person, right? And I'm a business person with a conscience that I think is really troubled by how things look right now. And I'm just going to do what I can do, and it's not a ton, but I think if I talk about it enough, right, and other people go, huh, that does feel good. So from a profit standpoint, the more company they purchase and tranches they have stemming from the five. But if you take the 5% of, you know, whatever, X million dollar company, and then you add a practice, you know, and then you add another practice, that 5% is now starting to generate enough revenue and profits that it can buy tranches, pay the loan. You know, the goal is to get to a place where there's enough to do both at the same time. The reality is our employees probably will not see streams of money flowing into their pockets because they've got to get in, they've got to get it purchased. And you know, right now, if I'm talking about how I sell this dream, it's like, be part of the change, like be part of something that makes a difference, right? Have a voice. For God's sakes, I can't guarantee, you know, Antonio at the front desk that I'm going to make him a millionaire. I'm probably not, right? But he can be part of something where he has a voice and he knows everyone is treated fairly and we're moving toward something that makes more sense, right?
How does it change the dynamics within the company between the employees?
I feel like sometimes I've been talking about it for so long. I mean, I really have been, it has taken so much longer. Because even in the world of people that work in employee ownership, this idea of a growth mindset coupled with a worker co-op is not common. Like, it's been done a few times in the country. Like, it's just not typical, right? Mm-hmm. And it's that get outside the box, everybody. Like, we put people on the moon. Like, we really can probably do something different.
Right.
And
I love the idea that you're expanding the co-op idea into veterinary medicine, because I mean, we've got REI, we've got these sort of local co-ops mm-hmm. that seem to be doing really, really well.
Yes.
So like, why not expand it into more industries?
Right. Right. And someone's told me along this journey, if you've seen one co-op, you've seen one co-op. Like, there's so much variance. And then if you think about it, like, did anyone teach us about cooperatives when we were kids? Not really. I grew up in the Midwest and you kind of saw them agriculturally. Like, there's agricultural cooperatives, there's consumer cooperatives, which is like REI and PCC, mm-hmm. and then there's financial co-ops, which is BECU,
sure.
right? And so they're out there, and then a worker cooperative is just another type.
So for the people who get into the cooperative, let's say I'm an employee and I move out of state, or I'm no longer with the company, or I just want to get out for whatever reason, like how does that work?
The cool thing about a cooperative too is like there's a membership fee to get in, and there's different ways to do that. Again, all different types of cooperatives. I know of a pizza chain in the Bay Area and they have several shops there and they're a worker cooperative and it's $3,000 to buy in, right? I'm like, oh, I want to take a different approach, at least to start, and then the cooperative long-term will decide. Like, down the road, they may decide, you know what, we want our membership fee to be higher because these are the things we want to do, whatever. But the way I want to get it started is no barrier, right? Our entry-level, lowest-paid person can get in. So is that $100? And you can do it $20 out of a paycheck over five, you know, just like zero barrier. How can we help? But you get that back when you leave. If you're like, oh, we're moving to Alaska, there's no urban animals in Alaska and we don't have a remote job for you, here's your $100 back, whatever you paid to be a member. And then everyone sort of has a ledger, right? And it's like, there may be money's owed and it's just sitting in there in your account or whatnot. And then that gets into the nitty gritty part that I'm like still learning. And yes, exactly. And the lawyers and the...
That's the other thing, is to find the support that you need to make this happen.
Yes.
Advice for people
my advice would be keep trying and don't take no. You know, I think when you're doing something outside of the box, there is no playbook, right? And it's hard to find people that have your same vision. But I think I just keep coming back. And I'm like, no. Why can't we? I don't want to do it. You know, you have to be comfortable to say, I don't want to do it that way. You know, I can't count how many times someone said, I think you should just do an ESOP, you know, and this is a CPA or some. Well, it sounds like an ESOP is what you want to achieve your goals. I'm like, no, I just said I don't want an ESOP. I do know what I want, right?
But that's the way things have always been.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's what people know. And now I've got, you know, a lawyer who this is all he does, and he's excited. Like, he's excited because it's something sort of new and different for him. So I just think that sort of, I don't know, be the change stuff is real.
And now that you're embarking on sort of this new venture for your industry. I'm wondering if you're getting people reaching out to you for advice or asking for...
Not yet, but I want them to. Okay. Not yet, but I, you know, that's the thing is like, again, I'm an entrepreneur. I think this is a no-brainer business model. No-brainer, right? And I'm super excited to build what we can build. There's no scarcity. If other people want to do it too at the same time, I think that's great because ultimately that's what our industry needs. And we are one company. And I hope we become a massive company, an influencer in our industry. But I'd like everybody else to be doing it too, yeah. right? And then let's just, you know, I don't think we're going to choke out corporate veterinary medicine. I don't think that's happening. Right. But I do think we can create sort of a shelter for veterinary professionals to work, yeah. like an option, an alternative, a reason to, I mean, the burnout rate in this profession is real. It is unique individuals that go into this profession. And I would argue a lot of us, you know, have traumas and that we then are even more drawn to animals. And even though no one's getting rich doing it, everybody's still drawn to animals, right? And like, that's a unique type of individual. And I was reading something where after the last recession, they identified vet med as recession proof, which it is, because the more we, and don't get me started on the human animal bond, but the more we humanize dogs and cats, which I'm going to suggest isn't good for anyone, but the more we do that, the less taking your pet to the vet is optional. It's not optional.
Right.
It has to be done. Right? And they see that. And to me, it's like, you know, versus this wallpaper and celebrating, it's in the crosshairs. Like that human animal bond is in their crosshairs. And they're like, money. We can make money. Yeah. Right? And those of us that do the work, and these people are like, whoa, why are you, like, now I'm a salesperson? You want me to convince people that this wellness plan, that your two-year-old perfectly healthy pet does not need x-rays and blood work this year. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say you're gonna be okay without that. But what people really need is someone to say that, yeah. right? Not because otherwise, like, you just scare them into doing things. And it's like, look, diagnostics are never bad. I'm not gonna be the vet that's like, we're doing too much. Like, fine, but yeah. you guide folks to yeah. their decisions. And the way we want to do that as veterinary professionals is for what makes sense for them,
yeah.
right? And their pet,
yeah.
not some packaged, commoditized crap. You know, I'm always like, if we're gonna keep care affordable for dogs and cats, which I'm like, if we love dogs and cats, which all of us do, we have to keep their care affordable. Because if all of a sudden you're a minimum wage worker and you can't afford to have a cat, now think of the dogs and the cats that don't have homes. People need that human animal bond. Yeah. If they want it, they should be able to have it. That should not be something that is left just to the wealthy, right? And so it's like, okay, if we love dogs and cats, we've got to keep their care affordable. But at the same time, you know, I have especially support staff who, it's hard. They're, you know, if you're not making over six figures in Seattle, it's a pretty tough place to live
yeah.
in a lot of ways. And you know, it's like, how do we raise up wages for our people that do the work, yet allow everyone to have a cat and dog? And there are sort of opposing magnets yeah. right now. But one way we don't do it is to have corporate taking a huge slice off the top and sending it up to like nameless, faceless shareholders,
sure.
right? Like, how, that's not gonna help, pretty sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't have an MBA, I'm not, you know, a business brain, but I'm like, I'm pretty sure that won't get us there.
As Sherry mentioned, finding the right people to help her down this path was the first step to making it a success. Adam Schwartz is the founder of The Cooperative Way, a consulting firm with a mission to help co-ops succeed. He's been working with Sherry and her team for the last couple of years.
I would ask you this, in your scholastic career from grade school to graduate school, did you ever learn about co-ops?
Of course not.
Of course not, right. So neither did I. And so I got hired 31 years ago to be a lobbyist with a group called the National Rural Electric Co-op Association. And then from there, I went to work for a rural telecommunications cooperative and then joined a group called the National Cooperative Business Association, which is a trade association of all different types of co-ops. And then 11 years ago, went out on my own and joined up with the Kuluminate Co-op as well. So My license plate says Go Co-op. I am a big believer that the cooperative business model is the best business model on earth, because it takes into account both the economic and social needs of the members and the communities that they serve.
And here in this Seattle area, we're familiar with the REI co-op. We've got a lot of grocery store, farmers market type co-ops. But those aren't the only industries where you can have a co-op. I think I was a little bit surprised to learn that there's going to be a veterinary co-op. So what other industries have you worked with that people might be surprised are co-ops?
If you can think of it, it can be done as a co-op. The only business I have never seen done as a co-op is the military. There can be co-ops in transportation. For instance, I'm sure everyone's familiar with Uber and Lyft. About a year ago, a group in New York City called Drivers.coop launched a worker-owned rideshare co-op. And so the difference between Drivers.coop and Uber and Lyft is that the people who are driving the cars are the owners of the business, not outside shareholders. Some of the most iconic brands that you can think of in agriculture are cooperatives. Companies like Cabot Cheese, Organic Valley, Land O'Lakes, Ocean Spray, Welch's, Sunkist, Sunmade, Blue Diamond Almond, all of those businesses are cooperatives in which the farmers own the business. And then at the retail level, there are what we call purchasing co-ops. And these are co-ops in which small business people have come together. Ace Hardware would probably be the one that has the most brand recognition. So each of the Ace store owners is a member of the cooperative. And what they're able to do is purchase all the products you see in an Ace store. But it's not just one person, one store buying it, but it's all 3,600 stores across the country that are purchasing. So it makes them price competitive with the Lowe's and Home Depot's of the world.
Looking at Urban Animal, how is it different working with a veterinary practice versus something that's retail?
So what Urban Animal is attempting to do is to convert from a privately held company to a worker co-op in which the workers will own the business. One of the biggest ones in the country is Equal Exchange. To folks in your area that shop at any of the food co-ops in the Seattle metro, they're probably familiar with that company. So they're a worker-owned co-op in which they import coffee, tea, and chocolate. And the workers run the business. They own and control the business. And that's what Urban Animal will be doing, is transferring ownership of the business from one person to roughly a little bit over 100 employees. Now, this is going to take some time, and it's going to take some work because, as we discussed, very few people have training in what a cooperative is. So that's what I and my colleague will be working on, is working with the employees to ensure that they understand how the business model operates, what the governance procedures are, and what the rights and the responsibilities are that come with in a worker cooperative.
Now, there have to be some hurdles or some drawbacks to this way of doing business. It can't be all roses. What are the difficulties that you have to address?
Well, one of the biggest things that we have to address is that most folks are not well trained in democratic workplaces. So if we think about our own lives, most of us, when we were growing up, our families were not very democratic. And then we go to school and there's not really a whole lot of democracy in school. Maybe there's a sandbox of student government that you get to play in, but it's not very democratic. And then you go off to work, and our workplaces aren't very democratic. So for a lot of people, getting used to what workplace democracy looks like, electing a board, selecting a management structure, making sure that we can get the financing so that the owner can get paid for their business. So there are definitely some significant hurdles that need to be overcome. But the good news is there are many businesses in this country and around the world that use this worker cooperative model with great success and greater worker and employee satisfaction because they go from an employee to a co-owner. So it's a really wonderful way to run your business. And I think a very positive impact on society as well, because what it allows the workers to do is to keep that control of the business locally. What we're seeing in the veterinary industry is private venture capital firms take over many small veterinary clinics, pushing out that local ownership in favor of large corporate ownership. So this is one of the ways through worker cooperative ownership that we can combat that type of consolidation.
Yeah. And one of the biggest hurdles that you have to get through initially is just getting the owner of the company to want to be a cooperative. I mean, they have to basically be willing to give up control of their own business that they've built. How do you work with them to like help them through that process?
So most often the owners of the business are interested in leaving a legacy that they're not just looking to cash out for the highest profit dollar, want to make sure that the business stays competitive and open and providing the goods or the service that they have in some cases for many years. And they don't want to see that business go to a large sort of a big box corporation because they know that the services that their current clients, customers would receive most likely will deteriorate. And in many cases, these small business owners have spent a lifetime, sometimes they're multi-generational businesses, and they want to reward the workers who have been a big part of that by giving them the real opportunity to own the business.
Yeah, I was thinking about if I had a business, let's say, and I wanted my kids to take it over, but they weren't interested. Maybe they wanted to do something else in another field. You know, what would I do with that business, right? This is a great way to allow it to continue, even if the kids aren't interested. But what about getting financing for the employees or the co-op group? How hard is it to lock down financing so that they can buy in?
So that can certainly be one of the great challenges of this. Thankfully, we're beginning to see more recognition among financial institutions about this business model. There's been wonderful work done by the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops, which is a national trade association of all worker co-ops, and with the National Cooperative Business Association to ensure that legal entities, legislatures understand this business model and that banks and credit unions will finance these opportunities. There are some designated cooperative loan funds and investment funds that truly understand the business model and can provide financing as well. And many times the owners who are selling the business will finance the business for a number of years as the workers can pay off the agreed amount of the sale of the business.
Sure. Now, as you're working in this field, have you seen a trend line? I'm curious if we're starting to see, I guess, an increase in cooperatives with the current state of the economy.
Worker co-ops are the smallest of the four major types. I mentioned that you have the consumer co-ops, such as PCC and Central and the credit unions. And then you have producer co-ops, the ag co-ops, and then the purchasing co-ops, the small businesses. Worker co-ops are the smallest, but the fastest growing, because there is great interest in this. People value locally owned businesses. And we know that because many non-local businesses try and pass themselves off as local. So we continue to see great interest in co-ops of all types and worker co-ops in particular. Based on a University of Wisconsin study from a few years back, there were 40,000 different co-ops here in the United States and estimates of close to a million co-ops worldwide. We operate in just about every country in the world. The largest worker co-op is Mondragon, which is in the Basque region of Spain. And I think people would be surprised about how many co-ops there are and that they're actually all around us. Whenever I have conversations with folks and tell them what I do, invariably say that's pretty cool. And I do a fair amount of work with electric co-ops, of which there are a number in Washington State. And these are co-ops where the consumers own their electric company. And that was started back during the Depression era. And there's some 900 electric co-ops around the country today. So the business model works, as I say, in every part of our economy. And if folks are interested in joining or starting one, there's plenty of information out there to help people.
And we've got some links included in the show notes of this episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the Deeper Dive with Kim Shepherd podcast so you get notified the next time a new episode drops. Thanks for listening.
The Deeper Dive with Kim Shepherd. For more in-depth discussion on the Pacific Northwest and beyond, visit nwnewsradio.com. Plus, catch 24/7 coverage on the news you need to know with News Radio 1000 FM 97.7, your information station.